The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Those of you who have been coming the last couple of Mondays know that for January I'm doing a series of talks in my attempt to introduce some of the core teachings of Buddhism, kind of like an Introduction to Buddhism series. And the evenings were titled Core Teachings, Core Practices, Core Attitudes, and Core Realizations. Can people hear okay?
Terrible.
It is kind of. So, yeah. So, it's fine on that side. So, let me see, maybe. Can I move this? Does that help? At all? So, today the topic is core attitudes. So, now that I'm going to talk about attitudes, is this better? Better? Good attitude? I thought of titling today Buddhism with an Attitude. And it is perhaps a little bit of an odd concept or idea, attitude. I haven't given it a lot of thought before. But I felt somehow, some vague way, somehow that the word, or the concept of attitude captured something very important about an approach or a way of approaching Buddhism, Buddhist practice, that's a little bit different than the teachings or the practices. It's saying, how do you approach it? Or the attitude or the with which you enter into it. And attitude, I'm sure that 20 years ago I would have felt much more uncomfortable by this idea of there's an attitude to be had when you practice Buddhism or you engage in Buddhism, because attitude seems something so private and so personal that to be told that should be adjusted or have a different attitude than what we have seems a little bit, maybe perhaps lacks some integrity, or perhaps seems too much like being told what to do or how to be, as if there's some authority outside of you that says, you know, tells you what kind of attitude you should have. But I think that there is a very core attitudes that are encouraged when you enter into Buddhist practice. And if you understand what some of these attitudes are, then I think the whole practice and the teachings themselves and the practice of walking the path is a lot easier, a lot lighter, less likely to suffer because of walking the path. I like to think of the Four Noble Truths, which are really the heart of the Buddhist teachings, as if they're really understood well, they're a protection from suffering even more because you're practicing. The Four Noble Truths is the truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, and the release from suffering. And if you're sensitive to those issues, suffering, the cause, and the release of it, the end of it, and if you look at that, from that point of view, look at how you practice, how you engage in Buddhism, you'll then hopefully notice when you're suffering because of how you engage. Some people strive too much. Some people are have too high ideals and they disappoint themselves because they don't attain it quickly enough. Some people are comparing themselves to others. I'm not going fast enough. You know, there's all kinds of ways, unfortunate ways, in which people suffer because of their contact with Buddhism. And since Buddhism is meant to be to help you become free of suffering, not cause you more suffering, you want to be sure to turn the Four Noble Truths to look at you, yourself, and how you're handling it. And so you feel your suffering connected to it, your striving perhaps, and then your clinging in relationship to it, or maybe your aversion, your resistance that might be coming up. And then you look at the cause of that. You see the resistance or the clinging or the craving, whatever it might be. And then you learn to release it, let it go, so that you can hold it all lighter. And lighter doesn't mean that there's a lot of effort and a lot of seriousness in doing practice. It just means that the seriousness or the fullness of the engagement, the wholeheartedness of the engagement is somehow has a light feeling, or it's kind of an easy feeling, light feeling. So in thinking about attitude, I believe that one of the fundamental attitudes that Buddhism encourages is an attitude that a consideration to consider what you're doing from the point of view of whether it's harmful to yourself and others or whether it's beneficial for yourself and others. And the attitude that's hoped in Udu Buddhist practice, an attitude of being concerned or interested in the welfare of oneself and the welfare of others. And according to the teachings of the Buddha, he offered both. He emphasized both, self and others. And for me, that's he said in a variety of places, he said that a wise person is someone who considers the welfare of oneself, others, and both. When he was teaching his own son, when his son was 7, 8 years old, he taught him the same thing. You should look at your actions, look at what you're doing, and consider whether it's harmful or beneficial for yourself or for others. So this idea of self and other, the mutuality, is very important. I call it the mutual benefit approach to a life. There's a strand current of teaching in the West, perhaps in some of the Western religious traditions, where there's a very sharp dichotomy, duality, between self and other that plays itself out in another duality, which is duality of altruism and selfishness. And the idea is you're not supposed to be selfish. That's just the worst thing you can do. And the best thing you do is to be altruistic. You should be altruistic. There's a moral commandment to be altruistic. And so in that kind of divide, then certain behaviors are approved and certain are not. And I've known people who've suffered under this kind of duality who felt, partly because of their religious heritage, who felt that a personal benefit of any kind, including feeling joy, delight, was somehow unspiritual. You're supposed to not have any benefit for yourself. And I've had the privilege once of telling someone who came from a particular Western religious background, a venerable old one, that it was okay to experience joy in meditation. Now, felt like kind of a privilege and also kind of a shock that I needed to say that to someone. But somehow she had gotten this message from her religion that that was not okay. And then also plays itself out where people, what's important is just to kind of give yourself up selflessly, to others. And somehow that selfless giving yourself over to others, there's some kind of maybe reward in the afterlife or something. In India, not just in Buddhism, but in Indian, there's a current, very strong current in Indian religious culture where the self and others are considered to be very interrelated, interconnected, so that if you benefit yourself, there are then benefits that that provides benefits to society, to others. And if you benefit others, that brings benefit to yourself. You're looking for how the two work together mutually. So if you become happier, then it's good for other people because that happiness spreads from you. If you're miserable and people contact you, people are going to feel depressed. So to work on yourself and become happier is beneficial for others. But if you help other people become happier, then you'll get high on that. You'll get benefits from that. And so it isn't a sharp duality doesn't exist so strongly in India. And rather the attitude is one that we're all in it together. Much more, I think, than this the duality of self and others sometimes looks at this. So an attitude of mutuality. So to have a spiritual life, a practice life, where what we're doing is we're trying to somehow benefit both. If we're trying to work on ourselves, as we do in meditation in a sense, then to understand how that benefits others. And one of the things to do in Buddhism is to actually intentionally think about, reflect about the benefits that you have received from practice. It's okay to do that. It's okay to have benefits. And reflect what it is and then actively consider how that can be beneficial for others, how it might spread out to others, how it might. So if you became a little bit calmer through meditation, then consider how that calmness might be supportive and helpful for others. If you're happier, then consider how that happiness can be helpful for others. So that what your own benefits don't stay with yourself. How you're benefited then spreads out from yourself into others. And then it's also reciprocal. That the benefits, the way you support other people, comes back and benefits yourself. And I like to think of that the way that people support their own practice community. If you come and sit with a community, and then you in return support that community, you're also benefiting from the support that you're benefiting from the welfare of the community. I felt that very strongly. I feel that here. I feel many places I practice that as I've made it possible for people to practice, supported people in practice in many, many different ways, then I benefit from that because I got a place to practice. And I got good people to practice with. And I feel so lucky. So one of the fundamental attitudes in Buddhism is the idea of mutual benefit, to consider how that works. Now, it's possible for people to practice very selfishly and some attitude of just for me. These other people are just a nuisance. And not only that, but, they're not as very spiritually advanced. And I'm going to, go someplace serious here. Get out of my way. Or some opposite ideas that people have sometimes that... I'm the only klutz around here, the spiritual klutz. And everyone else, they seem to be all on the brink of Buddhahood. And so that also kind of, creates this kind of divide in self and other, which is not very helpful. So we're all in it together, kind of. It's a mutuality, mutual benefit, and mutual support system. And certainly there are times, phases in people's life where the primary thing we're doing is maybe much more self-inward, much more inward, and so it's not so connected to others as much. And there might be phases, and it's understood this is a phase, this is useful for me. Someone who's been a gregarious extrovert their whole life, it might be really good to go off and spend a month in silence on a retreat and not talk to anyone. Someone who's been an introvert all their life and mostly holed up in their house, going on another retreat in silence maybe is not what's called for. Maybe what they should do is, join the IMC board. I just got a message in the mail today that this week that the Redwood City School District needs a new board member and they're looking for new volunteers. And I considered for a while, should I sign up for this? Because my son's in the Redwood City Schools, and should I kind of contribute and help? And I kind of thought about it for about half a second. And I thought, I bet that's a lot of time and a lot of people contact and a lot of phone calls. And I think I get enough. That's not, that wouldn't bring balance to my life. So... maybe one of you would like to be on the board. So, but there are different phases in people's lives. And I've certainly gone through phases of my life where I've been much more inward or much more kind of hopefully in a healthy way, reclusive, and times where I've been very actively involved and very social in my work and activities. And that seems to be the phase to be in. So this issue, this attitude then of how is it that I can approach this, my practice, my life, so it's mutually beneficial, is in the background attitude for Buddhism. And then it plays itself out in particular details. In the Eightfold Path, the second step is sometimes called right intention. It might not be the best translation. People tried other translations. And I think with a little bit of a stretch, we might see it as the right attitude. And in that description of right intention, right attitude, there are three attitudes which are encouraged if you want to do this practice. Or to say it this way, if what you want to do is this approach to the relief of suffering, both for yourself and for others, then there are these three attitudes which are really helpful. If you're not interested in freedom from suffering and liberation, you don't have to pay any attention to these attitudes. But if you want this, these three attitudes are really helpful. These three approaches of how you go about your day. And the first is, the word is in English, it's translated in English as renunciation. And renunciation the rumor is that renunciation is a very unpopular topic. And the rumor also is that Western Dharma teachers are reluctant to talk about renunciation because then people won't come back. But renunciation is meant to be quite a beautiful concept, attitude, approach to our life. And perhaps the word renunciation is the wrong word. The Buddhist word, the Pali word that the Buddha used for renunciation, nekkhamma, has kind of the connotation of going forth, going out, and going out into the wide open space. So it's kind of like you've had cabin fever. You've been cooped up all winter, snow's high, can't get out of the cabin, with 13 of your relatives. And you don't get to choose which ones. And then finally, the snow thaws, the storm's over, and you get to go forth, out into the wide open. And boy, does that feel good. So it's similar kind of the way that the Buddha talked about it. He talked about leaving the dusty household life to go forth into the wide open space. So you don't jump right on that as being, oh, this is kind of demeaning of the household life. Just kind of take it to be kind of the equivalent of cabin fever, the dusty household life. Since most of you don't have dusty household lives, you know, it doesn't relate to you. But when it's dusty, then it's a drag. So there's something about, being... And household in Buddhism means more than just living in a house. It means somehow being emotionally constrained, attached, stuck, caught up, under stress, in the kind of lifestyles and attitudes that lay people often have. So to not be caught anymore, to be free, to step forth. And so the kind of connotation of renunciation in the Buddhist English, not in English English, but Buddhist English, is the word renunciation emphasizes what is gained rather than what is lost. And whereas in English English, renunciation emphasizes what we're letting go of. In Buddhist English, emphasizing what we're gaining. And we're gaining something beautiful. And you're not asked in Buddhism to renounce or let go of anything, to simplify your life in any kind of way, unless you see it as an opportunity for greater well-being, for greater welfare, greater happiness, greater spiritual depth, greater spiritual freedom. So the Buddha said in one place, a wise person, this is a paraphrase, a wise person will give up a lesser happiness for a greater happiness. So this is if you have happiness, it's fine. But if giving up that lesser happiness brings you a greater happiness, a wise person would choose that. So if you're in the greater happiness, has to take into account yourself and others. So you don't just, if you're stuck in some kind of social situation, like a marriage, that you can easily imagine a greater happiness beyond, for yourself. But when you think about the mutuality, how it is for the whole system, for everyone, then you have a different analysis of the situation than it's just for yourself. What is it that's greater good, the greater happiness here? So renunciation is very important attitude. So how can I go about my life? How can I go through this practice and simplify, let go, hold things lighter, not be so attached, not cling to so many things, and be willing to soften up the grip that we have on things, on people, on status, on recreational opportunities, on finances, on praise from others, you know, that we might get from others, on success, on pleasure. There's a whole series of things that for some people are what motivates them most, what kind of gives emphasis in their life, meaning in their life, that you can even cling around it, a lot of meaning. And in Buddhism, those things are not to be clung to. The lightening up from them is part of the happiness. So, maybe I apologize if I did this for you recently when I talked about the Four Noble Truths, but I did it last Sunday, or two Sundays ago, for the children's program. I hold up a bell for them, and I ring it. Makes a beautiful sound. And then I hold it this way. So if you cling to the bell, it doesn't make a beautiful sound. But if you hold it lightly, you get a beautiful sound. So the renunciation part, the renunciation is in part holding things lightly. But things that are harmful, things that are harming you, you want to let go entirely, put them down. And so one of the things that happens as people practice mindfulness, and the mindfulness gets stronger and deeper, it becomes a more thorough understanding of what is harmful for us, what causes stress. And I think it's quite easy to live a life that's not very self-reflective and not to see the impact that our anger has, impact that our busyness has, impact that our, you know, all kinds of certain kinds of behavior have. And so we don't know that we're suffering, we're harming ourselves in the process. But if you stop a little bit, stop enough, and look and pay attention, start seeing the impact. And I've known plenty of people who have decided to give up their anger when they saw the impact it had on themselves. And they said, wait a minute, I'm harming myself more than the person I'm angry with. So that's quite an analysis, right? Some people want to have this hostility towards the object of your anger. And they realize that their enemy is hurting them more, that they're hurting themselves more than their enemy can ever hurt them. Because the enemy can never get inside in that kind of way. So what part of this attitude of mutual benefit is an attitude then of how can we let go, how can we lighten up on those things which are causing us harm? So to consider that, to an approach to life that considers that. The second attitude is an attitude of compassion. And sometimes the attitude of compassion is also the word that's sometimes kind of seen as talking about compassion. Also, it can be seen as talking about non-violence, to be non-harming and compassionate. And what a great day to talk about that, Martin Luther King Day. So to live a life that doesn't cause harm, to live a life that is motivated by compassion. So not only is interested in benefiting, mutual benefit, but actually sensitive to suffering, in such a way that our heart, in Buddhist language, the heart trembles in contact with suffering. We're moved by our contact with the world of suffering around us. And a desire, the compassion is a desire for that suffering to be alleviated. Compassion is more than empathy. Because empathy is just kind of sensing the experience, sharing it in a sense. But compassion takes it one more step where there's a desire, a wish for that suffering to be alleviated. So to have that approach of being sensitive to suffering so that compassion can arise is an important aspect of this approach, Buddhist approach. I think it's very hard to be told you should be compassionate. I don't know if it's possible to be just kind of just, okay, I'll just gear up then. But It's possible to be slow down enough to pay attention to the suffering in this world. There's a way of reading a newspaper, and you won't get maybe past the first page, but read a newspaper and allow yourself to really take in and reflect on the degree of suffering that's being described. You know, you read, someone or many people have died in Iraq. You don't just take numbers, that's interesting. But you sit and think, oh, that person, and that person's relatives, and friends, and neighbors, maybe children. And you get this kind of ripple effect. Boy, you know, there's this concentric circles of suffering that ripple out. And how long is that suffering and pain going to last? My father-in-law is a Dutch Jew who went through the German concentration camps. So that was 62 years ago since he was freed from the camps, right? 62 years? And that pain is still, he's still living with it, 62 years later. And I know people from generations. Civil War was for 100 years in America, the impact. So I read the paper sometimes and I see what's going on in Iraq, and it doesn't take much to break my heart. It's terrible to have the heart broken. And it was terrible to have these things happen. But there's something really right. If it's happening, there's something really right about letting that impact your heart and take it in. I feel somebody has to be a witness of it. Somebody has to take it in fully. If people aren't taking it in, then how are we going to be responsible in a good way to all that? How do we let that inform our life, learn from that, and move on from there? So to enter into our life with compassion, to have that approach, or at least be sensitive to its importance, to slow down enough for it, to be concerned about it, to have that as a value, is a part of the Buddhist attitude in this life. From that compassion, then, comes hopefully a greater inspiration, a greater motivation to practice stronger and to practice for others. I think that it's impossible at a certain point when people do Buddhist practice, for different people to different point along the so-called path of progress. At a certain point, it's impossible to practice anymore unless you're also doing it for others. And I think that the sense of compassion, the sense of the suffering of the world, it's possible to encounter it and have it snow you under. But it's also possible to encounter it and feel really energized by it and say, yes, I'm going to try to do better. I'm going to try to do my own practice better, meet my neighbors better. I'm going to try to live this life more fully in response to that. And I think that's the Buddhist attitude, to meet all that and not feel discouraged by it, but rather in a kind of way feel, I don't know if encouraged is the right word, but energized, motivated by that to make a difference. So renunciation and compassion. And the third is to have loving kindness, metta, to have goodwill. And it's different than compassion, because compassion is mostly has to do with suffering, and the relief from suffering. Goodwill is the kind of feelings we have towards people who aren't suffering even. Imagine that. And so a kind of an approach of kindness. Can we be kind here? What's the kind thing to do, or how can I be kind in this situation, or how can I be an expression of goodwill here? I don't know what word works for any of you. Some of these words might seem oppressive. Some of these words might feel meaningful. But you know, goodwill, friendliness, kindness, loving kindness, love. What other synonyms like that are there? Did I exhaust them? Kindness, anyway. I'd rather not have niceness be a synonym for kindness. That wouldn't be good, I think. That sounds like dangerous to me. Maybe you shouldn't be nice, but you should be kind. And so in Buddhist attitude, that's developed, encouraged, cultivated, is one of loving kindness. So it's an attitude to how you go about your day, how you go about your life, and it's found that cultivating loving kindness is very helpful for going along the path. It's very helpful because it creates good conditions around you. If you're kind, the world tends to respond nicely in return. But also, it's one of the best attitudes towards oneself. If you can be kind towards yourself, friendly towards yourself, then it's a lot easier to develop concentration. It's a lot easier to develop your meditation. It's a lot easier to negotiate all the difficult aspects of your psyche, your psychology, that might come up as you engage in Buddhist practice. It's been said, kind of cliche, that self-knowledge is seldom good news. And if that's the case, then you need a lot of compassion and kindness to encounter the parts of yourself maybe you would rather not encounter. And that's part of the path. The idea that you're supposed to kind of move to that which causes greater happiness doesn't mean that we get to avoid what's difficult. And part of a mature spiritual life is one that knows wise ways of how to practice, engage in what's most difficult, what actually sometimes is actually very unpleasant to encounter. And I'm inspired by the examples of the civil rights movement in the 1960s and 50s and how people, they did what was right in a way that hung in there with tremendous courage and perseverance, and it was very unpleasant to them, some of them. One woman I met stood at a street corner protesting the racial discrimination in the South in 1962 or 63. These white guys in a pickup truck came along, jumped out of the pickup truck, and beat her up. Her and the other people there, the group of people protesting. The next day, she went back to the same street corner, stood there in protest. Same guys came, jumped out of the truck, beat her up. The third day, she was in the same street corner. Same guys came by. Same guy jumped out of the truck to beat her up. Had his fist over her head, ready to pounce her. And he looked into her eyes and he said, "What are you doing?" And then they had a conversation. And there was no more violence. Now, that was pretty unpleasant. But there's something very powerful that allows a person to engage that kind of strength, that kind of sense of motivation, vision, that allows a person to stay present for something like that. So sometimes it works the same way, not only in our social life, that we need that kind of courage and dedication, but also with our inner life. And sometimes we have a sense that for the greater good, for the possibility of opening up to the greater happiness, that we need to have that kind of firmness and commitment not to give in to our own anger, our own violence, our own kind of things that go on inside of ourselves as well, and to sit there and be able to kind of deal with it when it's quite difficult for ourselves. So sometimes a Buddhist attitude, a core Buddhist attitude, is courage. Courage, persistence, resolve, strong sense of resolve, what we're going to do. So I could go on and on and give you a long list of further attitudes, but that's probably plenty. These are kind of core. But I want to, before we end tonight, I want to point out that I think it's useful to consider that all these attitudes have their shadow, and that a Buddhist community who are trying to live by some of these values and some of these attitudes will have its shadow as well. And a shadow here, what I mean is behavior, feelings, motivations, thoughts, which tend to get unacknowledged, not looked at, unexamined, because somehow they're not accepted as part of the norm. They're not acceptable in the culture. And so, you know, it's, you know, in many Buddhist communities I've been in, perhaps here at IMC, where attitudes of letting go, of kindness, compassion, niceness, are, you know, held up as being valuable, and then, you know, if people are somewhat shy to come around and show that they're grumpy or angry or hostile. And so that part of themselves kind of gets really, we get really quiet about it. So as a community, even if we might know it ourselves, the community as a whole doesn't know that this is present. So it becomes a shadow of the community, the hidden part of a community, of a culture. Or sometimes it becomes hidden from ourselves, and people have blinders about themselves as well, because what they think has to be normative. And now this is not, you know, wrong in the sense that that there is in fact an ideal community out there that has no shadow, and we should become like that. I believe that every community of people, whether it's a family or a neighborhood or, you know, a culture or a society or community like ours, has shadows. That just comes with territory. And so to know that and be sensitive to that. But the function of a practice, inner practice, mindfulness, meditation practice, spiritual practice, I hope, that its function, one of its functions is to reveal the shadows. And if you have a culture without a practice, then watch out. It might come back and bite you in some way. But if you have a culture with a practice, hopefully then they kind of, you get the best of both. They balance each other out. They clean themselves up. So these attitudes of mutual benefit, of compassion, of renunciation, letting go, kindness, can all have their shadow. Renunciation can have the shadow of letting go of things inappropriately, letting go before you're ready. Because you, you know, it's just good to let go. You don't want to show your friends that here, that, you know, you're holding on, clinging to things. And so you let people let go inappropriately. Compassion and loving kindness, the shadow of that is that we might not be aware or be sensitive to feelings of hostility or anger or grumpiness or unkindness that might be, you know, judgmentalism, a variety of things that might be going on. Maybe they're unfortunate things, but we don't notice it, we don't pay attention, and they kind of work themselves out in other channels in kind of unfortunate ways. The shadow of this emphasis on mutual benefit might be that there's a phase of a person's life where really they need to be very private or inward or secluded. And somehow, you know, that seems un-Buddhist because they're supposed to be concerned with both self and others. So that's not good. So there's always these evaluations that end up causing some difficulty. And part of the way that the practice is a protection is that one of the things we do in the mindfulness practice is to pay attention to where the stress is, where what is uncomfortable is. And if there's a shadow being created, if you're sensitive, you'll feel the discomfort. Something feels a little bit off. And so because you're quiet enough to notice where you're off, and you look at that and investigate it, then you hopefully catch it. And if you catch it, you want to be really honest about it, and at least to yourself. And I hope that we can be honest together as a community as well, that we can be grumpy and be accepted for that. And if you feel unkind, I hope you don't be unkind, but if you feel unkind, I hope that as a community is an okay place to say, I'm feeling really unkind. I'm feeling really hostile. And, oh, okay. Well, that's nice. We can practice together. But don't be hostile. If you can help it. But you're allowed to feel that way. So we can practice with it and work with it. All that. You're allowed to come here as you are. You know, you don't have to kind of make yourself into some kind of special Buddhist person to come to IMC. But just, you know, come as you are, kind of party. So I hope that was understandable. And I've never given a talk like this on right attitude or core attitude, so hopefully that represented the tradition well enough. And so next week, we'll do the last in the series, and we'll do the core realizations. Thank you.